Hello, and welcome to the Great Birth Rebellion podcast, where we grapple with current research to help you get the best out of your pregnancy, birth, and postpartum journey while still challenging the dominant birth culture. I'm your host, Dr. Melanie Jackson at Melanie the Midwife, and I'm joined weekly by my co-host, Bea, from Core and Floor Restore, and this is the Great Birth Rebellion.
So, it may appear that I'm reading, and it's because I am.
I feel like that's how we need to start this podcast. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of the Great Birth Rebellion. I finally got to say that. That's the first time I've said it, and the only reason I got to say it is because Mel's sleep deprived.
I'm a bit slow off the mark. B's like, great, now I'm just going to swoop in, take the intro.
I magpied the intro.
The backstory is that I think last week I said to everybody, I've just been at a birth. And today I've just been at a birth too.
Life of a midwife.
I know. I'm really in it, guys. You can really feel confident that I'm not just speaking in an ivory tower. I'm actually on the ground, in the trenches, caring for women. It's all happening. I'll have a nap after this. So
okay, I want to take care of you.
Yeah. All right. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of the Great Birth Rebellion. Sorry, I couldn't do it. I feel like Sheldon from the Big Bang Theory.
You are Sheldon from the Big Bang Theory.
I feel like when he knocks three times. I had to say that so that I could get into the podcast. So welcome, everybody, to this.
And then you have it.
Episode of the Great Birth Rebellion. Today we're talking about a concept that has previously been a bit hard to prove, and we're still actually in the process of proving it. And it's been knocking around for a long time. Certainly I heard it before I was a midwife, and I've seen it written in literature in the 60s and 70s. I don't know who coined the term. I'd love to know who the first person was that said.
Do we really want to love to know? Because it's got to be a man, sure. Oh,
no, they can't not mention. I reckon some hippie.
Maybe Sheila did it.
I don't know. I need to dig deeper. Maybe
I'm going to try and dig while you, because I'm fascinated now.
I want to know the origin of that term, the cascade of intervention. Because it's become, you know, just something we all as midwives go, oh, yeah, the cascade. And some knowing women know about the cascade of intervention. And that's what we're talking about today, is the cascade of intervention. And I love that phrase. It's such a visual way of describing what can happen when you interfere with birth physiology. And so that's the concept we're talking about today. Right. We're going to work through this in detail, and the cascade of intervention is linked to the medicalization of childbirth globally, and we have plans to discuss the medicalization of childbirth in the coming weeks. So today I really want to focus on the cascade of intervention, realizing that it's very easy to slip into conversations about medicalization, but we're going to leave that over there for a second and come back to it. Today we need to focus on the cascade. So if we're going to define it, the cascade of intervention, I want to also talk about the nuance of it. So we're going to consider the cascade of intervention, but also just kind of nibble at the sides of the idea of the cascade of interference and the cascade of omittance. I'm calling it, that's me. I've never heard anyone say the cascade of omittance.
I love how much recognition you are just stamping into history right now. Like in 200 years time, and be like, check that episode of the Great Birth Rebellion. I reckon one of them said it. It wasn't me, guys. It was Mel. And she wants to be known for it. Honey, take it. I'm still looking up. I can't find the origin at all.
I did look. I did actually try, and I was more interested. I just didn't think it would add to the episode, so I stopped trying. But I appreciate that you've tried. But the cascade of omittance is what I'm calling. It's not providing something that women need in order for their labor and birth to progress physiologically, and just considering if the cascade of omittance is part of the cascade of intervention or the cascade of interference. So what does that mean? Let me see. The cascade describes the need for more intervention to remedy the impact of the previous intervention. So that's a nutshell definition. I'll say it again for people who are like, what did she say? The cascade of intervention describes the need for more intervention to remedy the impact of the previous intervention. And if we backtrack a little bit, if we describe what an intervention is, because I want to just really focus on the fact also that interventions are not all bad, but we have to acknowledge that they're not all good either, because some people believe that everything you do to intervene in labor and birth makes it better and safer and more successful, and that it couldn't possibly introduce more risk or more danger or a side effect into your birth process. And that's not true. That's what the cascade of intervention is acknowledging that while some interventions can improve birth outcomes, we have to acknowledge that they can also make outcomes worse as well.
And there's a whole lot to that, because what is an outcome? And it can actually be jumbled. So it can make some outcomes good and some outcomes, like satisfaction, experience, not good. So it may, you know, we know that some interventions are life-saving, then has really good outcomes associated with it, and it can also have bad outcomes, like disappointment over the fact that that intervention was necessary. So it's not all just good versus bad, or necessary versus unnecessary. There's a lot to it. It's really multi-layered. It's not just a linear trajectory of I get this and now everything goes up, onwards and upwards, which is often how it's sold. It's often sold as just a single set process. We'll do this and then we'll do this and then this will happen and it'll all be okay. When actually it can go up, down and round and round.
Yeah. And sometimes you'll have an intervention and it works exactly as it was intended and there was no side effect. And sometimes it doesn't do any of what you're expecting it to do and only gives you more problems. So this is what we're grappling with, I suppose, because I don't want people to hear us saying that all intervention is bad and you shouldn't have any intervention because they all lead to the cascade. That's not true. That's not what we're saying.
Yeah, I think it needs to swing back in the opposite direction in terms of seeing that most interventions right now are not necessary and the amount of interventions necessary is actually small.
Well, let's talk about necessary versus unnecessary, because this is the next stage in the conversation. CB, I told you last week that intelligent people can predict where a conversation is going, and you've done it again.
Put me down in herstory for being able to predict stuff. It's just my intuition, babe.
Yeah, nice. All right. So our purposes for today, we're going to focus on interventions during pregnancy, labor, and birth, because there are interventions that are routinely applied during postpartum and that are routinely applied to babies. But today our examples and focus are going to come from the time of pregnancy, labor, and birth. And so we'll mostly be focusing on the impact that these have on physiology and the process of labor and on the woman's body. Of course, the woman and the baby are a dyad and they're inextricably linked, but I just wanted to be clear that's where our focus was for this episode, because there are cascades that occur for babies after birth, and that is probably a topic for another day. We're going to hone in to pregnancy, labor, and birth. So in our context, an intervention is the process of interfering with or acting to alter the course or outcome of a woman's pregnancy, labor, and birth process. So the interventions can either have a positive effect and result in correcting the course of labor and birth that's gone wrong, or they can be counterproductive and actually cause pathology in the process, essentially interventions into the physiological process that alter its course are what we're talking about today. So as B was saying, they can either be necessary or unnecessary interventions. And unnecessary interventions are often seen as what we would call routine. So interventions can either be routine, where basically it's, I call it birth by numbers. You know, like if you get a painting set and they go, put the green here, put that green number 8 here, put blue number 7 here. It's paint by numbers. Routine interventions are like birth by numbers. So when you go into hospital, midwives have this mental checklist in their head. Okay, this woman's walked in. I need to find her a room, put a CTG on, do a VE, whatever the tick list is. So it's birth by numbers. That's what we would consider routine intervention, something that just you routinely get when you walk into a hospital. And they can either be that, or they're done in response to an event or a circumstance that's occurring, and whoever's looking after you feels that it's a necessity that you have this intervention in light of what they're seeing. And people's feelings about how necessary interventions are rooted in their philosophy of childbirth. So some people believe that without any intervention or supervision in your birth, without a health professional there, without clinical skills, there's no way your birth could go well. Other people sit at the complete other end of the spectrum, believing that if you have somebody there who can clinically intervene, your birth is more likely to go wrong. So we'll discuss more of this in the medicalization episode, but where you see necessity of intervention is deeply rooted into your philosophy around childbirth. So if you trust that childbirth is physiological and will mostly go well without intervention, then you're going to assume that most intervention is unnecessary. The other end of the spectrum is if you believe that birth is a medical event and therefore needs management, then you're going to assume that you need every single intervention that's coming your way in order to stay safe.
Well, it's also deeply rooted in your belief system around Western medicine and hierarchy. The fact that it's believed is the power that he or that she hold in society as well. So it's not just about your belief on childbirth and what it needs. I kind of see that as like that horizontal layer. That vertical layer is where your power lies and what you believe and who you trust. So that trust in hierarchy and trust in what health professionals or medical professionals or people of power say is going to really impact this as well.
Well, it's really, you're right with the trust thing about women's perception of an intervention. You know, if I, for example, take a client into hospital and the staff there say, look, we need to do A, B, and C, and she says, no, I don't want any of that. If she then looks to me and I say, look, actually, I really do think you need A, B, and C. I think that's what we did come for. And she knows we're of a similar philosophy and she trusts that I wouldn't lie to her or, you know,
recommend something that you didn't think was necessary.
Correct. So if she goes, wow, if Mel thinks it's necessary, then that actually changes my belief about if this is necessary or not. So it can be quite impactful how much you trust your clinician and what your relationship is about as to
the
whether
environment, like everything that's going on around you in your pregnancy and birth, that's all going to impact this as well, because it's your place of safety and then what you need in order to be safe. And often we will draw on those connections and other people. This is really multi-layered. And I think if you're listening back to this, having had a birth where you feel like you've had the cascade of intervention, really bringing compassion to all that was going on around you at the time, because it does impact. You're always doing the very best you can with what you have. And sometimes we can look back and go, that wasn't what I wanted or what I needed. And there can be a lot of grief around that. But yeah, it's all interconnected.
Exactly. And that's why I really wanted to piggyback this with the medicalization chat, because I feel like they're so interrelated. So if we're looking at interventions and we're thinking about the routine ones, they're usually the ones that are not clinically indicated. So there's nothing, there's no emergency, there's nothing gone wrong at the moment. This is just policy and procedure. This is what everybody gets regardless of circumstance. And sometimes these are your screening things like a vaginal exam. It's a screening tool, and it's performed with the purpose of trying to find or identify a problem or diagnose something that's not currently obvious. Whereas
the biggest one's probably ultrasound and vaginal examination in pregnancy. Yeah. I would say they're the two biggest, because the national pregnancy guidelines state that the last ultrasound should be 20 weeks. It doesn't feel like that. It feels like that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, this is the issue with routine ultrasounds. You know, we know, we've got research that shows that a 36-week growth scan, for example, done routinely, doesn't improve outcomes. It actually increases the risk of induction, because then they make assumptions about the size of the baby. And so all of a sudden you're doing routine interventions to try and screen and find problems, and this kicks off the cascade. And those interventions are the ones that women often talk about as being unnecessary. Like, I wasn't in any danger. No one was in danger. We were just doing them to find a problem and to diagnose and screen. So then there's the emergency and clinically indicated interventions. And these are the ones that are performed once there's a problem that's been identified. So we're using an intervention to try and diagnose, understand, or reverse or resolve a problem. So, for example, so I'm a home birth midwife. We don't do routine vaginal examinations. In hospital, you're likely to get them every 2 to 4 hours, depending on your circumstance, as a routine practice. But I was with a client a little while ago who had a very long labor. And we were getting to the point, you know, almost 30-odd hours in, where everyone, including the woman, was wondering what was going on. And we all agreed together that we thought a vaginal exam would be appropriate at this time, because we were in an unusual circumstance. She felt things weren't progressing. I noticed things weren't progressing. She was feeling stuck and tired. And we thought, right, we need to understand what's happening here. And then it was discovered that the baby was not in a position where it would be able to come out at home. So when we got to hospital, you know, a manual rotation was done and the baby came out. This was what we all deemed a necessary intervention that, when applied, had the ideal outcome. So often in emergencies, women have agree that those were a necessary intervention and the benefits outweigh the risk. Whereas I think with routine interventions, it's not clear if the benefits outweigh the risk of doing that intervention. So I think when you're trying to work out, is this an intervention that I want and that I think is necessary, you can try and weigh up, does the risk of this outweigh the benefit? Would it be better for me to have this intervention, or is it likely to expose me to more risk than benefit?
And this is where I think we live in a society that really values the intellect, and we value what people think rather than what people feel, which is the intuition. And pregnancy, birth, and motherhood really pull you into that intuitive state. It, like, that your body wants to be really listened to and heard. And so often it's about creating that space to actually listen to what feels good for me. Because the number one thing I see with this cascade of intervention is that the women will go, I knew at the time this didn't feel right for me. Mm-hmm. And they didn't acknowledge it. They didn't listen to their body. And often it comes from a state of being the good girl. And they're like, I was told it was necessary, or my partner was worried. And so they conform and they fawn. So fawning is that people-pleasing state of the nervous system. And so they go into a nervous system state where they're literally in survival mode, and how they're surviving is to please others. And often they will please their care providers or their partners. And then in the post-birth scenario, when all the information is there, they're able to actually sit in their body and go, ah, that didn't feel good. The regret and the replaying and the I wish I didn't have it and all the rest of it, that comes when the intuition has been ignored. I really want to invite care providers to start asking questions about feel. How does this feel for you? What does this feel like in your body, as opposed to what do you think? Because that encourages people to drop down into their body and make a decision that feels good for them, like a full body yes, right? Is your brain, heart, gut, and womb all saying yes to this decision in intervention? And if you, you know, it's really about valuing the pause. And if you get that pause, that can be the difference between sitting in your power and having something that feels good, or handing your power over.
Well, and as you said, it's like in those circumstances, women say to themselves, I don't want this, but I know I need it. So with that woman who we transferred that had the manual rotation, she's like, I don't want to go to hospital, but I know that I need to go to hospital. She was walking herself out the door. This wasn't the plan, but
yeah,
she knew what she, and so she had all these things and the outcome was good. And she's like, you know, would have preferred to stay at home, but I absolutely did need to go. So.
And the difference there is the difference between the word need and should. Because I need to do something is definitely that intuition saying this feels right. I should do something is typically, the word should is typically connected to our cultural conditioning. Stop and pause and go, should I have this or do I need to have this? Because, yeah, should is always based on our cultural or societal conditioning on what we think needs to be done as opposed to what we feel needs to be done. Really, really cool tool to be aware of is your language and how you're approaching things. So if there's a should, pause, really drop into your body. Am I doing this because I feel like I should do it because somebody's telling me I need to, and do I agree with that?
And the previous 73 episodes of The Great Birth Rebellion are about trying to help you guys work out which interventions you think are necessary and which interventions you are not necessary. So there, I know everyone's looking at us going now, well, Mel and B, tell us which interventions are necessary and which ones are not. And that's actually unique to every single individual birth. So we can't tell you what is an unnecessary intervention, except to say that they're usually the routine ones when you're not in actual danger. And so if you want to know, if you want to get a better understanding of what is a routine and what's a necessary intervention, you've got to listen to episode 1 to 73 of the Great Birth Rebellion podcast.
All in one hit.
That would be quite the bender. That would be an absolute bender of a week if you did that.
I think probably the biggest ones, let's give them the biggest ones, 100% ultrasound. Like the amount of care providers that just do an ultrasound at every appointment, that is an intervention that often starts the cascade of intervention for many people because it finds things that we weren't even looking for or perhaps don't even need to know about. So that's probably my biggest red flag one is ultrasound. And 100% vaginal examinations in pregnancy and CTG. Probably the biggest three.
Yes. We did a CTG episode with Kirsten Small. We spoke all about that and the necessity or not of CTG.
That was birth though as well. I feel like when we first started out, Mel, it was the cascade of intervention was kind of not 100% limited, but mostly had to do with labor and birth. And now I feel like that cascade starts at like 9 weeks of pregnancy.
Yeah.
Like it really feels like it's extended and it's initiated a hell of a lot earlier. So it just feels like that cascade is really just being initiated and often initiated and ceased and initiated and ceased during the pregnancy. There's different cascades of intervention that are happening. Like it's just feeling a bit wild.
Well, we've been around, like what we're in our 15th, 16th year of midwifery, clinical midwifery. And one of the studies I looked up, which I will touch on as we go, looked at interventions over a 20-year period and how much they changed and how they're not linked to an improve in outcomes, and actually discussed that the cascade of intervention, as interventions increase in number, they're also exponentially increasing in number because then you have to factor in the addition of the cascade. And so, I mean, we had back in when we still had glucose tolerance testing for every single woman in their pregnancy. And if you were diabetic, then it led to induction and extra ultrasounds and all these things, failing to actually acknowledge the research on gestational diabetes testing, which we did do a full episode on, and how inaccurate it can be and how unnecessary it is to do for every single woman, that we really should be selectively screening women. So that does trigger all kinds of cascades for the rest of your pregnancy and birth care. So it can be anything that triggers the cascade that basically leads to another intervention that requires another intervention that requires another one in order to remedy the impact of the initial intervention. So, I want to further define the cascade, but as I was researching this, it occurred to me that we are looking at this whole idea of the cascade of intervention through incredibly privileged eyes and within a context that has high access to quality medical care. So here in Australia, where we are, and most Western countries, we have the problem of too much intervention and too many resources, when other countries, they have a problem of not enough intervention and resources. And so, like, both extremes are problematic. I think it's two problems. I think some countries have a problem where they don't have enough access to interventions, and that causes poor outcomes and ill health. The other extreme, which is the problem that we're addressing here today, is the abundance extreme, where we use interventions simply because we have them, without always considering if they're absolutely necessary. So, I mean, there's two problems. The problem that we're
addressing. Two problems, and neither outweigh each other. They both exist, and they're both valid, and they both need love and attention. Thank you.
Yeah. So the problem B and I are talking about, because we're looking at it with privileged eyes, is the abundance problem. And so there are people listening today who wished that they had had access to an intervention, but they didn't because of their location or lack of resources or systematic failures or decision-making at the time didn't allow for it. So we realize that the rejection of the opportunity for intervention comes from a position of absolute privilege. And what we're talking about today, it just fails to speak to the experience of countries where they have poor access to medical help in childbirth and where it's lacking. And so that's the other extreme, it's not enough. But we can talk from our experience of too much, that women and care providers in low resource countries are strategizing ways to provide intervention to women in order to improve maternal and newborn outcomes. The flip side of that is that we in higher resource countries are working to reduce interventions in order to improve outcomes for women and babies. Because something that happens when you either have not enough intervention or too much intervention, that it starts to have a consequence on the well-being of women and babies. And so our problem is that our interventions, and this is not me saying it, I will be talking about a paper later that is questioning the concept that interventions are always done for the good of the woman and the baby. The question now is that is all this intervention we're doing actually counterintuitive and creating harm? And so that's the discussion we want to have about this. So we know that the vast majority of birth will go well without interference. However, if we're to truly understand birth, we've got to understand that there are absolutely times when physiology does not work the way that it should. Physiology fails. It's a hallmark of humanness, of bodies that are not perfect, that our bodies sometimes don't work, and that interventions can and do have a role in that to help correct physiology that's turned into pathology. The trick is finding the balance.
We also sometimes, our bodies are put into situations where not working, and I say that in inverted commas, is actually a protective mechanism, right? And so perhaps our physiology would have worked in a different environment, And that, I mean, we have to acknowledge here that going into a hospital is an intervention. Getting into a car is an intervention. That's not something that our physiology expects to deal with in labor and birth. It's an interruption. Right. I think sometimes physiological birth not working is actually physiology working beautifully in the environment that it's put into. Because a lot of people turn around after birth and think that their bodies have failed them. And often I look at the situation and go, wow, your body did exactly what it needed to do to protect you and your baby in that situation. And sometimes it needs help, regardless of whether that's environmental or not.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the skill and trick in this is that you have a clinician who you can work in partnership with to decide, do we need to intervene? Which interventions would you be willing to have? Do you feel like you need them? And together are making those decisions, because every intervention has the desired result, has a desired result and an undesired result. That you can't just have all good or all bad. So it's weighing up the risks and benefits and deciding if it's worth it. So the cascade of intervention denotes the concept that when you perform an intervention, that you can alter the course of a labor and birth. And if the birth is unfolding physiologically and then an intervention is done as a routine thing, this can throw off the delicate flow of labor and introduce pathology into a labor process that was not currently pathological. And it can cause events to cascade into pathology. And this is medically caused. It's what we call an iatrogenic consequence, a medically induced consequence. Alternatively, if the birth is unfolding pathologically and an intervention is performed, it can redirect the labor into a physiological path. So that example I gave before where we transferred in, manual rotation was performed and the doctor said to the woman, push out your baby. So the doctor did the intervention of manual rotation. The woman's body was still contracting and she pushed out her baby. It was a minimal intervention, maximal impact. Like that altered the course of her pathological labor, returned it to a physiological path. But that's not always the case. And that's where the cascade of intervention is mostly noticed, because you need one intervention to fix the next. So, I mean, some examples of the cascades. There are countless. Like, when I was a student, I went on a little journey on paper, a paper journey, and I thought, I am going to make a map of the cascade of intervention, like a flow chart, like if this, then this, you know, yes, did that happen? No, did that happen? Those kinds of things. It's impossible to map that kind of thing, but research has linked certain interventions to other interventions. So. And something that I've seen happen, for example, if someone ruptures your membranes, breaks your waters and causes a cord prolapse, which leads to an emergency cesarean section. So something I've witnessed occur when I was a student. That is an immediate clear cascade. If that midwife hadn't broken those waters, the cord wouldn't have prolapsed at that time. She wouldn't have needed a cesarean section. And similar, like epidural, for example, an epidural can cause a baby to turn into a posterior position, increasing the need for manual rotation or forceps or vacuum, or possibly leading to a cesarean section. Or I've also witnessed an epidural where a woman's been having a really long labor, has had an epidural, managed to have a sleep, relax her body and mind, had a snack, and then dilated and progressed in labor. Like, I've seen that before too. So you just can't predict it. But what we need to recognize is that there's short and long-term cascades. So a short-term cascade could be, I've had an epidural, so now I need an augmentation to get my labor going again. Or if you lengthen out that cascade, so I had an epidural, which did lead to a posterior baby, which led to the need for a cesarean section. You've then pushed out the cascade all the way through to your next birth as well, where now you're feeling the impact of that initial cascade on your next pregnancy. And so this is a long-term cascade. They just push the risk and the cascade up the chain for women. So the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare report that the most common reason for a cesarean in Australia is a history of previous cesarean section. So 86% of mothers who had a previous cesarean section are having a repeat cesarean in their subsequent birth. That's a cascade of intervention. So every cesarean that a woman has increases her risk of something going wrong in that next birth and in subsequent pregnancies. So it's not just in that moment. And there was a great study. Bea, did you have anything to add? Because I'm about to launch into this study that I found, 2021. She's like, yep, go for it, sister. All right. So there was a great study done here in Australia by Fox et al. In 2021, where they looked at almost 100,000 women who gave birth over a three-year period in Queensland public hospitals. And they wanted to make kind of this diagram that I was just talking about as a student. They wanted to make a chart to examine the factors that were contributing to the two top clinical conditions that led to cesarean section for women in Queensland. And the two things that, the main two things that were leading to cesarean section are a fetal heart rate anomaly, so abnormal fetal heart rate, and what they call inadequate contractions. So that usually means either a long labor or the labor pattern isn't what they were predicting or expecting it should be to lead to adequate progress towards birth. So this could be the term, I hate the term, and we're going to do a whole episode on it, but failure to progress, where you're having a slow labor and you
call it labor dysostosia. Please stop calling it failure to progress, people. It's labor dysostosia.
Yeah. And so, yeah, those were the two major reasons that women were having cesareans. And so among the sample of women who had a cesarean section, 41% of them who had the cesarean section experienced fetal heart rate abnormality. So abnormal fetal heart rate was the reason for cesarean in 41% for women. But then the study asked, but what was the reason for the abnormal fetal heart rate? And the authors had a look at the sample where abnormal fetal heart rate was present, and 39% of those mothers had their membranes ruptured artificially, so their waters were broken by a midwife with a hook or a doctor. So of the 41% of women who had cesarean sections for fetal heart rate problems, 39% of them had had their waters artificially ruptured, and only 20% of the mothers did not have their membranes artificially ruptured. So you could almost double the chance of fetal heart rate problems if your membranes are artificially ruptured, which can then lead to the need for cesarean section. So now we see a correlation between artificial rupture of membranes leading to abnormal heart rate, which led to cesarean section. So, which was more so in women who didn't have their membranes ruptured. So that was the first tracking that they did with this study of 100,000 women. So now another thing they noticed was that among women who had oxytocin for induction or augmentation of labor with artificial oxytocin, so syntocin or pitocin, 32% of those women experienced fetal heart rate changes compared to 17% in mothers who didn't have oxytocin. So now they notice that augmentation and induction increase the chance of abnormal heart rate and therefore led to those primary cesareans. So this is the cascade at play. If they've been able to track that there's an increased risk of cesarean section and an increased risk of the causes of those cesarean sections when you do things like artificially rupture a woman's membranes or initiate the use of artificial oxytocin for induction or augmentation. Then they also looked at epidurals, and 52% of women with an epidural who had a cesarean section had their cesarean section because they had an abnormal fetal heart rate, compared with 38% of mothers who did not have an epidural. So this study is saying that if one of the main reasons for primary cesarean section is abnormal fetal heart rate, and what are some of the main causes of abnormal fetal heart rate? It's labor interventions such as epidurals, artificial rupture of membranes, and the use of artificial oxytocin to speed up labor. Then they looked at this sample of women who had inadequate, I'm using inverted commas, inadequate contractions. And inadequate contractions were associated with 33% of women who had had an epidural compared to only 10% of women who didn't have an epidural. So now what they're noticing is that you're almost, or you're over, you're three times more likely to have inadequate contractions if you have an epidural. And inadequate contractions, again, using inverted commas when I say inadequate contractions because it's horrendous language, inadequate contractions was one of the main reasons for cesarean section. So now they're linking epidural to a reduction in uterine action to the need for cesarean section. So this paper in 2021 kind of, it was a big paper, and it brings together what clinicians have already been noticing about interventions. But there was another recent paper, 2021, by Rydell, and they state that current labor practices have seen an acceleration in interventions to either initiate, monitor, accelerate, or terminate the physiological process of pregnancy and childbirth. And the number of interventions increased during their study period. So they looked at interventions over a 20-year period. They noticed the increase in the use of intervention, but the increase in the number of interventions that each woman needed, in inverted commas. As interventions, they interfere with the physiological process of labor, and they carry potential risk of short and long-term consequences. And the findings in this paper call for careful reevaluation of contemporary maternity care with a first do no harm perspective. So now we've got researchers suggesting that to actually give unnecessary routine interventions is harmful and against the moral and ethical ethos of medicine.
I mean, this is something I've talked about in my free antenatal classes, is that so often when you hear people's stories, and people's stories really do influence our belief systems and they influence the choices that we make, we can look at the outcome and go, I'm so grateful that I was in a hospital because I needed a cesarean. And actually, when we start to look back at, well, what led to the cesarean, what led to the epidural, what led to the induction, what led to the ultrasounds that led to the induction, we often can see that what you're grateful for is actually what we caused you.
Yes, that's what I was just about to rant about, that exact thing.
Yeah, and I talked about that in the free antenatal classes, and I say it with deep love and compassion because no person in the system goes, I'm going to do this so that I mess with your labor and birth. There's a lot of things that happen that people do that they truly believe in, and there's a lot typically of midwives that are doing things because they have to, not because they actually believe in them. But yes, our society is often very grateful for the interventions they've had because they truly see them as needed.
And it's real. I mean, it's not like you're artificially in danger. You actually are in danger, and you do need the next step in the cascade because someone's flipped the domino at the beginning, right? And so
I can see how overwhelming this podcast would be for those listening to this, because they're like, well, what's the first domino? Domino needs to be flicked and which doesn't. And this is why we have produced all the other episodes, is to actually, I think probably one of our biggest motivations for turning up here every week is to decrease the cascade of intervention, decrease the cascade of unnecessary intervention. That's why we've turned up. That's why we've created this. And that is what you and I are here to try and turn around and go, actually, birth isn't, for most people, very dangerous. And what is dangerous is unnecessary intervention.
Exactly.
And for some people, necessary intervention is life-saving. And, yes, there are situations where we look back. I was talking about this yesterday, actually. I remember being at, it was a woman who had planned a home birth and had decreased fetal movements that her partner actually picked up on. She didn't. And she rang me and I was like, come in, let's get checked. And the CTG went on and straight away I was like, oh my goodness, this baby's in danger. Like straight away. It was an intellect and an intuitive, oh my goodness. And I remember the doctor saying, well, we'll start an induction. And we did the induction, baby crashed instantly from the induction. As those of us that had really thought about it knew that it would, went straight for a Caesar and that baby came out white and it was incredibly anemic. I've never, ever seen a baby like that at birth. And you look at that situation and everyone was like, thank goodness for all of it. Thank goodness for the hospital. Thank goodness for the cesarean. But the majority of it, we sit there and go, well, that wasn't needed, that wasn't needed, that wasn't needed, that wasn't needed. And sometimes it's not needed because of the system and sometimes it's not needed because of culture. But, yeah, I think there's a lot of gratefulness for unnecessary intervention.
And the complexity is that the interventions start becoming necessary because the cascade is kicked off.
And yes.
If you have an intervention that leads to a complication, you have to remedy that complication. And so the rest of the interventions become necessary. But we've got to be super careful because this is the distinction between medically indicated intervention and unnecessary routine intervention. And by no means are we suggesting that you decline emergency interventions. Like interventions are there for when things don't go well, but consider if you need an intervention if nobody is in danger. That's kind of,
I think too, it's just about awareness that one thing can lead to another. And you know, there's the cliche saying, but it's 100% true, knowledge is power for most people. I do want to say it can be really overwhelming for others. But this is what we're trying to give here is knowledge that one thing often isn't just one thing. Yeah. One thing becomes another, becomes another, becomes another. And the more you're aware of that, the more you're able to perhaps stop that cascade, even have some choices around it, or enable it to actually feel okay of, yes, I'm making this choice and I understand that there may be more choices to make down the road. And so it's not about what we think you should do. It's about enabling you to have the time and the ability to make a choice that feels right for you in that circumstance.
And that's fully informed. So if you've listened to this podcast today and gone, do you know what? Actually, I'm cool with the possibility that I might be exposed to the cascade of intervention because I do want an epidural. And so I'm willing to accept the increased risk that it might cause distress in my baby, that it might cause a posterior position that might then require manual rotation or
Oxytocin just to bring contractions back, or it might,
or cesarean section. And then you might go, you know what, now that I know that that's possible, I'm still willing to accept this intervention. So I think that's also the idea of today, is to make you realize that there is the possibility of the cascade, and then it's up to you to answer whether or not you're willing to take the risks of that versus the benefits. So if you need an epidural or you need an augmentation or an induction or a vaginal exam or you want to have your waters broken, that's fine. It's just about knowing that there could be other outcomes other than the one you were expecting. And are you cool with that? Mm-hmm. If you're in that camp where you're thinking, right, I do not want to accept unnecessary intervention. I want to protect myself from the possibility of a cascade of intervention, we actually have some beautiful research papers that give women direct information about how you can keep yourself safe from unnecessary intervention and put yourself in a situation where you might only need to accept very necessary intervention. And some of the strategies that the research is talking about is they've suggested using intermittent auscultation of the fetal heart rate instead of CTG as a way to keep yourself safe from a cascade. So that means using a Doppler instead of continuous monitoring. Favoring non-pharmacological labor and pain control interventions. So we had a whole episode on managing labor without medicine, which you could go back to as an option.
And my free antenatal classes talk all about that.
Yeah.
Avoiding the admission CTG, that's a huge one. That increases cesarean section by, I think Cochrane says 20%. Like, so that's where you walk in and they just put you on a CTG, just a routine care. Like, that massively relates to a huge cascade of intervention. Just that one intervention as soon as you walk into the hospital.
Yep. And the other ones that can reduce your risk of being exposed to the cascade are having one-to-one support during labor. So that could be a doula, the robust friend that we spoke about last week, your own actual care provider, your own midwife that's looking after you. These are things that are shown to keep you safe from unnecessary intervention.
And well, the two biggest impacts we have on our labor and birth in Australia are who you birth with and where you birth. And so they're the biggest impacts on your cascade of intervention. So we know that your chance of having a cesarean section in Australia at the moment is not based on your risk status or your health status or your wishes. It's what matters is which door you walk through and who you choose to be on that other side of that door.
Correct.
So where you birth, who you birth with. That, I feel like that statistic sums up the cascade of intervention perfectly, as well as next week's episode that we're going to talk about, which is the medicalization of childbirth.
Yeah. And so think about it. If you want less intervention, you've got to go for a less interventionist model of care. And that's usually with midwives, and that's usually as far away from a tertiary hospital as you can get in terms of either having it at a birth center or at home. And the further along you go into, so public hospitals are typically less interventionist than a private hospital. That's a very generalized statement, but if you look statistically.
Statistically, there is good evidence that shows that.
Yeah. And then, you know, considering declining routine interventions that are not being applied because you or your baby are in actual danger. So you determining for yourself, does this feel routine, something that everybody would get, part of birth by numbers and labor care by numbers, or am I and my baby in actual tangible danger and is something actually going wrong that needs to be corrected?
And so, I think the two biggest things around that is to know that nothing should ever be based on time. It should always be based on well-being.
There's another reason why people might be encouraging intervention in a time-sensitive manner, and that is constraints of the system. So
the whole bed management issue. This is a bed management issue, not a labor issue.
Staffing issues, where I've heard clinicians say to a woman, I have this skill to do this right now. The person following me that's coming on in 3 hours does not have this skill.
Yeah. I had a debrief just yesterday where the woman was like, I was told I had to birth between 9 and 5. And then when I was starting to give birth at 2 o'clock, that was really scary for me, like 2 a.m., sorry. That was really scary because I had been told my whole pregnancy I had to give birth during this time, and then I didn't end up giving birth during that time. And, like, yeah, that's...
So there's system constraints. I mean, it's not about necessity, but it kind of also is, because you're at the mercy of the location and of the care providers.
I think it's naive to choose to birth in a system and not think about all the things that impact the system and that may actually impact you. It's just super important to know it's not just you. There's a whole system that's surrounding you that's going to impact your baby and your body.
Yeah. So, nutshell, cascade of intervention exists. You can either choose to keep yourself safe from that by making decisions about which interventions you believe are necessary and which are not, or accept the possibility that you'll be wrapped up in the cascade of intervention and be okay with that when you choose to accept interventions. So we're not saying don't take interventions. We're just letting you know that the cascade is a possibility, and now it's up to you to gauge what you want to do with that information. Amazing. That's the cascade of intervention, ladies and gentlemen.
We will see you in the next episode of the Great Birth Rebellion.
I'm not going to be out of sleep now. You can't.
Go for it.
Now I've got to finish the knocks. Okay.
Come on, Sheldon. Bring it.
That's been this episode of the Great Birth Rebellion. We will see you in the next episode. No, it wasn't any good. I'm not in a state of flow.
That's why I took it.
Thanks, guys. That's it. That's a wrap. That's been this week's episode. We will see you in the next episode of the Great Birth Rebellion.
Thanks for listening with us today. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and join our mailing list at melaniethemidwife.com. Mel sends out weekly emails with access to all the evidence we use in this podcast. You can find out more about Mel at melaniethemidwife.com and find out more about me, Bea, at coramfloor.com.au. We can't wait to bring you next week's episode of the Great Birth Rebellion.
Yeah! Yeah! All right.